You're listening to Paranormal Portal on Revolver Podcasts. Everybody, welcome to the Paranormal Portal podcast. I hope you guys are having a wonderful night, and thank you so much for tuning in and supporting all that we're doing here on the podcast. It's been amazing. You guys have been amazing out there checking us out and subscribing and downloading, and it's just a real pleasure. Of course, I'm your host, Brent Thomas. This is the Paranormal Portal podcast, and once again, special thanks to Revolver Podcast for making all this possible. Our guest tonight is just an iconic figure in the UFO field. He's the former co-director of the J. Allen Hynek Center for UFO Studies in Chicago. He served as director of special investigations for 10 years, multi-best-selling published author, and of many books regarding the Roswell incident. And he is the founder of the UFO Museum and Research Center in Roswell, New Mexico. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Mr. Donald Schmidt to the show.
Gentlemen, good evening. Great to be here. Thank you.
It is a true and rare pleasure to have you here. You are one of the people, one of the most instrumental people in digging into all of the mystery and obfuscation surrounding what was one of the most epic incidences of modern ufology, and probably was one incident that really brought it into the national consciousness more than any other. How did this all start for you? This is such an amazing journey.
It has been, and we say it's the Roswell's the granddaddy of all UFO cases. It's in the last 25 years, it truly has become a household word around the world. Just last year, again, I was to China three times and to Russia this fall. I have a 5-city tour of Australia, and in the past, South America, and certainly throughout Europe. I'm going back to Japan, and they all want to hear about Roswell. I can assure you it's not to talk about a mobile balloon or anything else conventional. Yeah. It's because they realize the governments of the world, you know, are pretty much unanimous as far as their stand on the very topic of UFOs in general. And it becomes more and more incumbent on us to break through that wall. And I like to believe, hopefully in my lifetime, and certainly in yours, that we're finally making some inroads. And I always start off by emphasizing the fact that I was a complete skeptic on this. In fact, after the first book came out, Roswell Incident in 1980, by Charles Berlitz and William L. Moore, I wasn't even interested enough to pick the book up. I 5 years later, I even wrote a paper that I just could not accept. I could not believe that something of this magnitude could be kept a secret all that time.
Right.
And then with the Center for UFO Studies, when I made the proposal before the board of directors at that time, that I wanted to look into Roswell. I felt we would make a single weekend jaunt down to New Mexico and prove that this was something conventional, prosaic, such as the balloon that the government still maintains after all these years, or something, you know, just as reasonable, just as rational, that type of thing.
Uh-huh.
And that was in February of 1989. And it was for having talked to the first 10 witnesses who actually handled the wreckage, handled the material. And no matter what the alternative explanations, I don't care if it is, you know, a mogul balloon or the original Rowan target balloon, and then getting into other writers who have come up with Japanese experimentation and even a German flying wing with Russian children, you know, piloting the craft, that type of thing, or first atomic. Oh, yeah, it's unbelievable. But what we always refer to these as theories of the month, because it's like, let's throw this one against the wall and see if people believe that, you know.
Sure.
But they never consider the eyewitness testimony of this nearly indestructible material, this paper-thin wreckage. Mm-hmm. That was practically weightless in your hands. You couldn't cut it. You couldn't burn it. Even a bullet wouldn't penetrate it.
Wow.
We have descriptions of engineers at the Roswell Army Airfield in 1947 and taking a larger sheet of the wreckage, about 4 feet in length. Mm-hmm. And they're pounding on it with a 16-pound sledgehammer. And the hammer just bouncing off time and time again, not even scratching this tissue thin material.
Wow.
And I always encourage people, like next time you're at a Home Depot, pick up a 16-pound sledgehammer.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll go through your car like tissue paper.
Yeah.
And this, it wouldn't even mar. It wouldn't even scratch.
Wow.
And then you have the I-beam sections of the same material with the hieroglyphic-like symbology that ran the length of each piece that made no sense to anyone. And yet there were a lot of these structures. And then there was the microfilament-like silken strands of material that you could hold a lighter up to one end, and the light would emit out the opposing end. Well, they're describing fiber optics in 1947.
Wow.
And yet fiber optics weren't developed until around 1970. And then the most amazing material of all, and we have both civilian and military describing what I'm about to portray. And that is the same paper-thin, metal-like material that was nearly indestructible, no matter what you did to it. But this, you could crumble, you could crease, you could fold, you could wad up into a ball. And when you'd release your grip or you'd place it down, it would smooth right out. It would flow like water right before your eyes and return back to its original shape and size without any sign, without any indication of deformity.
Wow.
We refer to this material as our holy grail, because this is the wreckage that would prove the UFO phenomenon overnight.
Yeah.
Overnight. And this is why we continue to have the archaeological work at the debris field. We've had now 5 such archaeological projects, and we're planning on a 6th.
Oh.
Still looking for that holy grail. But listening to the witnesses describe those very characteristics, those features, over and over again, and in the same terminology, in the same points of reference, mm-hmm. and you realize, well, first of all, they're not describing any type of balloon, any type of balloon radar kite. They're not describing any aircraft, any rocket of any sort, and they're certainly not describing an errant atomic bomb. They're describing something that, even by today's standards, is beyond our technology.
Yeah.
And that's where I quickly realized that we needed to treat this like it was the genuine article. Mm-hmm. I didn't need to continue being skeptical and trying to play devil's advocate and then find maybe a year or two later that, oh my God, I wasted all that time. And here we're dealing with something truly extraordinary. And now I have catch up, and now I have to go back and re-interview all these people and then find out what they really were describing, what they really attempted to portray to me as being the actual event and the materials that were involved that were recovered back at that time. So we decided we were going to treat it like it was real.
Yeah.
We didn't need much much coaxing. We didn't need much, as far as provocation in that regard, because the witnesses, and it basically came down to, we were going to go wherever the evidence took us. Right. Oh. And I think even too many scientists, they have a preconceived theory, an hypothesis, and then they set out to prove it. And they ignore a lot of the data as a result, because they cherry pick. They only use that which applies to their preconceived, you know, notion of what they're looking for. We allowed Roswell to dictate the terms, take us wherever it would. And we were willing to follow, whether it was something conventional, whether it was the original Rowan balloon device, or whether it was something truly fantastic. And it's like the old Sherlock Holmes axiom, that after you eliminate all the possible and you're left with only the impossible, you have to accept the impossible. And that's exactly where Roswell has taken us. And it's because we were legitimate skeptics and we followed a course, a specific methodology that allowed the event to provide us with the final outcome. And that's where we happen to be. And it's the granddaddy of all UFO cases as a result.
Yeah. What an amazing story, though, too. And you know, I got to give you guys a lot of credit, because for most people, when they officially research something like that, usually they come in with their own predispositions, and they come in with their own ideas, and that's what they're looking for. And so I really commend you guys for taking your egos out of it and just letting the story come to you as it unfolded. That's brilliant.
It obviously wasn't that difficult, in the sense that for the first couple of days of that first trip, it looked like we indeed may be correct. We were only talking to some third-hand witnesses at that point. Mm-hmm. And then we were talking to witnesses who wanted to talk about their personal UFO experiences, which had nothing to do with Roswell in 1947. But those were focused all in the Albuquerque area, because we flew into Albuquerque, and then we had the 200-mile drive down to Roswell. But before that, we had actually arranged to go out to the original debris field that the ranch foreman, W.W. Brazel, first discovered and first, you know, started this whole chain of events. And I can honestly tell both of you that when we arrived there, it was like we had stepped onto a battlefield. Oh. It was a very solemn moment, because, first of all, it hits you that what if indeed it happened precisely at this location as described?
Yeah.
And so it's a very sobering position to be in, because you just don't, you know, treat it as though just one more pasture, one more parcel of high desert in the central part of New Mexico, Lincoln County, you know, that type of thing. We paused for a moment and we took it in. Mm-hmm. And I can honestly tell you that the second time we arrived there, we gleefully ran across the site like children experiencing as far as just that ultimate dream come true.
Yeah.
That we had arrived. We were at a location that most researchers have never had the experience. We've had many people, you know, will you please take us there? Will you, next time you're out there, you'll have to take me along. Well, from Roswell alone, it's a 3-hour drive each way.
Oh.
And a good part of it is cross country. So it isn't a case of turn at this sign or turn at this cactus, turn at this bush, you know, that type of thing. You literally need someone to take you to know that you're at the precise location.
Sure.
And true to our word, we have kept it secret to the ranch owners that own the property surrounding the site. And then the very location itself is Bureau of Land Management conservation property, which it has been for over 100 years.
Oh, okay.
And it's leased back to the ranchers for grazing purposes only, for cattle and sheep. And as a result, whenever we've worked there, we have to leave it pristine. We've actually been, they allowed us to do some major excavation with backhoe equipment, with tractors, with big shovels. And I believe because we have always been totally professional and upfront as to our intentions and our respect, not only for their regulations, but also for the property, the site itself, that we have this wonderful ongoing relationship. And true to our word, we have not made it into a tourist attraction.
Right.
There is a monument that we placed out there in 2003, and it's about a half a mile from the actual location. It's overlooking that arroyo, that particular pasture. It's close enough, mm-hmm. and that's how I put it to anybody who asks. It's close enough because our site is still an active archaeological site. We really are very careful concerning the risk of contamination and anybody salting the site. Mm-hmm. God knows the military have been out there many times through the years. In fact, they continue to catch them out there within recent years, still looking around. They hired the ranch hands, the ranch owners. You hear their stories of how often they'll catch Air Force personnel at the very location.
Wow.
So
do they confirm
them? They are still very interested as to what we may find and what they themselves may still find at the actual location. But it's a race to the moon in that regard.
Yeah.
And so let the better men win, so to speak.
Yeah. Now, are they confronting these people when they see them? Like, hey, what are you guys doing?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I'll give you an example. In the mid-1980s, there was a ranch hand by the name of Jeff Parker, who actually chased down a Jeep that came bobbing down the hill from the windmill. It's called Pump Site Number 1, that in the original story, the rancher, one of the things he complained about was that he had to circle the sheep 2 miles around the debris to get to the water trough, which is at Pump Site Number 1, that very windmill. So that's one of the landmarks, one of the features at the site. Well, there they see this Jeep come bobbing down the hill from where that windmill is located. And there's a heavy chase that then takes place. And The Jeep finally pulls over, and Parker jumps out of his pickup truck with a loaded Winchester rifle. And because that's how they are. That's how the ranchers are. They shoot, be honest, they shoot first and ask questions later.
Sure.
And he's waving the rifle in their faces, and he immediately sees on the side of the Jeep, United States Air Force. Well, isn't that curious? And then he sees that there are two. Now ask yourselves, what's wrong with this picture? There are two middle-aged men, and one is a corporal, and the other is a first-class private. Well, it's what officers often will do when they go out into the field and go to places they shouldn't be. They will impersonate low-level enlisted men. These are middle-aged men who are clearly officers, and they're wearing enlisted men uniforms. And their excuse is they claim that they're there for doing a final location check for the establishment of a low radar tracking device for tracking drug smugglers coming in from Mexico. There's no such thing. I can assure you, there's no such thing. Well, it sounded important enough, but Parker kept saying, "You're on private property. Get the hell out of here right now." And Parker said that he saw that there were all types of maps and drawings on the dash and on the between the two bucket seats in the front of the Jeep. And so they agreed they would leave. But then the corporal, the 50-year-old corporal, then asks, "You saw where we were. Is that where that UFO supposedly crashed back in 1947? Well, Parker didn't know what they were talking about, because that's one of the things that even the ranch foreman and the ranch owners always keep secret. They don't even tell their own staff, their own ranch hands, about the significance of that very ranch. So he didn't have any ideas. So he said, "I want you off of here right now." And they finally, they just left. But this is an 85,000-acre ranch, and the nearest base would be Holloman in Alamogordo, which would still make it about a good hour, almost 2 hours away. Jeez. So to suggest that they were just out taking a casual, joyride through the desert, no.
That is amazing.
And I could cite other examples, but we would take up another half an hour. But
well, no, it's just really interesting that they're still coming back. Right. To me, that would seem to imply that they must feel that there's more for them to find there. And I'm curious with that, because as I understand it, the original collection efforts were pretty thorough, weren't they?
You would think.
Pretty thorough. But then when you consider that Brazel's very son, Bill. And Bill and his wife, Shirley, they were living up in Albuquerque at that time. And all of a sudden they see on the upper right-hand corner of the Albuquerque Journal, someone they recognized. Well, it was a picture of Bill's dad, Mac, the foreman from the ranch.
Right.
Who went in the Roswell and started this whole, this whole situation. Uh-huh. And it mentioned that he was being held in custody by the military. So Bill says to his wife, "Well, we better get down there, because Dad doesn't have any hired hands. There's nobody to mind the livestock." Mm-hmm. So they would make the drive down to Albuquerque, from Albuquerque down to the Corona Ranch. And it was just after the military had completed the entire recovery operation. But according to Bill, you could still see that the whole area was trampled, and heavy tire tracks, heavy equipment. And there was a 10-foot wide furrow that went for hundreds of feet that something had impacted and skipped across the ground.
Right.
Wow. And he was the first of a half a dozen witnesses who would describe that feature and the location of it. Well, anyway, in the ensuing months after heavy rains, Bill would ride through that particular pasture, and lo and behold, there would be some of these pieces of wreckage.
Oh, man.
Well, he found enough pieces to fill up a cigar box. Mm. And his wife, Shirley, would even describe to us that there was one particular piece that he kept in his leather chaps. And every evening when he would sit down to dinner, she would watch how he would pull that piece out from his chaps, and she'd watch how, no matter what he would do with it, and it was about the size of a handkerchief, mm-hmm. and he would try to poke his buck knife through it, and he would hold his lighter up to it, and then she would watch how he would crumble it up, and every time he'd place it down, they would both watch as it would unfurl, wow. as it just smoothed right out, right before their eyes, and night after night, day after day.
Wow. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back again on the other side with Mr. Donald Schmidt and continue his journey into the mysteries of Roswell. Don't go away, everybody. Back, ladies and gentlemen, to the second half hour of our show tonight. Our guest tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is Mr. Donald Schmidt, who is deeply involved and instrumental in bringing light the truth of the events of Roswell, New Mexico in 1947. And he is joining us tonight. And it's been an epic discussion. And thank you so much for being here. Before the break, we kind of stopped you, but if you'd like to continue, that would be great.
Of course. And I'm going to just digress for a moment, and I want your audience just to envision the following anecdote, because first of all, just as a bit of a backdrop, one of the things that became quite evident in the very early stages of our investigation was that anyone who managed to get a piece of the physical evidence, mm-hmm. they made every effort to hide it. They, you know, would put it under floorboards as far as in a shed or behind a fireplace, a loose stone, or in a crawl space under their home. What would possess not just one person, I'm talking about dozens of people, what would possess all of them with the fear that they needed to hide this stuff?
Right.
Unless it was, again, something truly extraordinary.
Yes.
You certainly aren't going to hide pieces of a balloon.
Nope.
Or even a plane. I keep asking people, you know, just the zeitgeist of the time. The fact that the military walked on water post-World War II.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. It was a whole different mentality as far as towards our GIs, our airmen, you know, the men, the people that had saved us as far as from World War II. Mm-hmm. And they still, in their respect, they feared enough reprisal, whether they were in the military or civilian, that they felt the need to secure,
yeah.
hide physical evidence of something extraordinary. And the point being that the military behaved the same way as the civilians. They all behaved as though this was an extraordinary event. Mm-hmm. It's not that the civilians, you know, acted like a bunch of lay, naive individuals who overreacted. It's not like the military that some low-ranking enlisted men over, you know, became overly excited about something they just didn't comprehend or didn't understand. Mm-hmm. We're talking all the way up to the highest levels of the military, down to even children who were involved. They all reacted the same way.
Wow.
So here was Bill Brazel on one occasion where he is over at a neighboring ranch. And there was a young girl by the name of Sally Tetralini. And she was working outside, and he pulled up with a pickup truck and got out, and he immediately asks her, "Did you ever see anything like this before?" And he has this piece of metal crumbled up in his hands. And he holds it out in front of her, and she described to us how she watched how it just flowed between his fingers. It just draped and perfectly smooth over the palm of his hand. Wow. And her immediate reaction was, "My God, wouldn't it be wonderful if clothes would be made of such material? I would never have to iron again." So it provides a wonderful visual of what she observed, mm-hmm. and how she equated it to the mundane. What she, you know, performed, the things that she did in her day-to-day life, and her own perspective, the way she could relate to it. But nonetheless, it provides this wonderful illustration of what she possibly observed.
Yeah.
So, again, does this sound like a weather balloon? Does it sound like, you know, anything but what the witnesses are describing? So, good old Bill, he's playing pool one night in the nearest town of Corona. And one of his friends just happens to bring this up. "Well, Bill, you know, your dad got in a lot of trouble over that. And, you know, by the way, did you know you ever find anything yourself?" To which he responded, "Well, I found a few scraps." That's how he put it. "I found a few scraps." Well, who should be at his home
the
very next morning?
Oh.
But an officer, an officer by the name of Captain Emerson Armstrong, who we verified. Armstrong was the one who paid Brazel a visit with three non-commissioned officers. And Armstrong says to Brazel, "We know what you have, and you will give it to us." Mm. And again, you know, the military, the respect that we had for our armed forces at that time, he turned over the whole box. Wow. Didn't hold back. Point being, this was 2 years after the incident. 2 years later, they were still watching.
Yeah.
Now, the irony coming full circle in all this, the very first time we were at the ranch house, back in February of 1989, our first skeptical visit to New Mexico, when we thought we were going to, you know, be able to package this in the one neat little explained former UFO incident, and yes, the government, you are 100% right about this. Well, we're at the ranch house, and there's an old abandoned water tank just brimming with sheets of rubber and foil and other materials, and it's full of water. And we ask, what's all this garbage? What's all this in this tank? Well, they told us that it was the ranch foreman at that time. His name was Jeff Wells. And he said to us, "Well, those are all the balloons that have been recovered on the ranch for all these years. And because we don't want the cattle and the sheep, which are like goats, you know, we quickly clear this stuff up because, you know, they eat everything in their path." Mm. So we make sure. And these damn things have been coming down on the ranch for, you know, for decades. The point being, they were no strangers to these weather balloon devices. Right. Oh. It's off-the-shelf material that a five-year-old child, I mean, our grandmothers on their deathbeds would recognize.
Sure.
And yet, the very conception that the most elite unit within the military at that time, the 509th Bomb Wing, the best officers, the best pilots, the best crewmen, the best doctors, the best nurses. If you swept a broom on that base back in 1947, you were the best sweeper in the military because you had a top security clearance and you were in charge of the atomic bomb. You were the first nuclear bomb squadron in the world. And the thought that they, of all people, wouldn't have recognized the very balloons that they themselves were launching twice a day in conjunction with the bomb drop exercises that they were conducting on a regular basis. So, you know, none of this connects. None of this, you know, we're not able to plug any of this into any rhyme or reason.
Right.
Except that once again, the skeptics, well, as the late Stanton Friedman would say, don't bother me with the facts because I already have my preconceived position.
Right.
It can't be, therefore it isn't. Doesn't matter what the evidence. We used to joke with the late Philip J. Klass, one of the most notorious of all the skeptics, you know, that you could have one crash in your backyard, Phil. And you do everything to make sure the world didn't find out about it because you'd have to finally eat crow. You'd have to admit you were wrong.
Uh-huh.
You know, and as we just, you know, went through my journey, that no matter should we have proven it was a balloon or anything else conventional, that's exactly what we would have accepted.
Sure.
And that would have been our final summation regarding all this. But it's because we are having to rely on the eyewitness testimony.
Mm.
And, I mean, I have colleagues that mean very well, and they say, well, you know, you can't trust eyewitnesses. And then I would remind them, well, all of history is made up of nothing more than eyewitness testimony.
Oh, good point. Yeah.
It's all we have. Mm-hmm. Everything that we cite chapter and verse and even all the press accounts, it came from eyewitnesses to an event. And there's a Japanese murder thriller from 1950 called The Rashomon Effect. And The Rashomon Effect is based on the principle that there are three positions to every event, that three people, or I should say, two people witness something, and yet there are three positions. There's what you believe, there's what I believe, and then there's what really happened.
Mm-hmm.
And the point being that based on one's environment, their background, their education, their influence throughout life, that we all have human influences that then cause us to perceive things differently from the next person and the next person and the next person. But the point being, who of the two opinions is still making every effort to determine what actually happened? Well, I can assure you, it never has been, and it never will be, the scoffers, the debunkers.
Sure, right.
Because their position is, we tell you this is what happened, and accept it. Take it or leave it, this is what happened. As juxtaposed to us, who are still trying to determine exactly what happened. So who is the more legitimate? Who is the more scientific? In still trying to determine exactly what happened.
Yeah.
Now, I would also then add, for those of us who were alive on November 22nd of 1963, the Kennedy assassination, mm-hmm. and we could move that up to 9/11 as a more contemporary example, mm-hmm. for all of us, we will remember exactly where we were, what we were doing, and what we were thinking at the time the news broke. For the rest of our lives.
Yeah. It's just imprinted so solid. Yeah.
And were any of us in Dealey Plaza in Dallas in 1963? Were any of us in New York who witnessed as far as the two planes strike the Twin Towers? Many were, but for those of us who weren't, we still will always remember.
Right.
And then to suggest that the very people in New Mexico back in 1947 who held the wreckage in their hands, who saw firsthand what they were dealing with, and to suggest that, wow, their memories are faded and they're unreliable, and you just can't trust that after all this time that they have a clear impression of really took place back then. They really just saw a balloon, and they confabulated this into something off the planet, sure. because they're trying to exploit this, and they're trying to make themselves famous, and they're trying to build museums, and they're trying to write books. Well, sorry, again, ladies and gentlemen, whether we're talking about the children, whether we're talking about four-star generals, they're telling us it did happen exactly as the eyewitnesses said it did.
Yeah. You know, the thing that really is curious to me, and even in your description, as you were explaining the wreckage, we have all these super advanced materials. And yet, is there any idea what could have brought this incredible thing down?
And that's why I say nearly indestructible.
Right, yeah.
Because obviously anything that's manufactured has to be malleable at a certain point. Mm-hmm. And if we would even use the example of our materials, the tensile strength, the combination of specific alloys back in 1947 would possibly be at this level. Mm-hmm. And then where are we in 2019? Well, I'm sure we're much higher. Well, whatever this is, it was even higher yet.
Sure.
But nonetheless, it whatever caused it to explode, to break up, it reached that fracture point. It reached that stress point that it caused it to break up into pieces. It was way beyond anything that we had, even by today's standards, but nonetheless, it did reach that that breaking point.
Hmm. Okay. And it literally did explode. It wasn't just a spark plug not firing or something. I mean, it blew.
Well, it was a meteor explosion based on even the impression of Major Jesse Marcel, who was the head of intelligence of the 509 bomb group. And he was one of two who were first dispatched by base commander Colonel William Blanchard to follow the rancher back to the site and check this out firsthand. And it was Marcel's immediate impression based on the pattern, the way the debris was scattered for almost 0.9 miles, that they immediately concluded that this was a mid-air explosion.
Wow.
The ranchers described that at the time, the night before, that there was a severe lightning storm. And between the thunderclaps, they heard what sounded like an explosion. So one could, again, imagine that it could very well have been struck by lightning, or it was an internal malfunction. They ever made that determination, and we certainly are going to speculate. I mean,
sure.
So again, all we can deal with is the fact that we have a huge amount of debris scattered for almost a full mile. Mm-hmm. But But nonetheless, we did confirm through the Stallion weather site that the late evening of July 2nd, Wednesday, July 2nd, that there indeed was a severe thunderstorm that came off of the southern Capitan Mountains through Lincoln County during that evening and during that very time in question. So we've confirmed the weather. And who knows? You know, people, again, they quite, well, you know, you travel all that distance through space and then you get caught up in a storm and you're not aware. Well, again, we're trying to think alien. Right. We're trying to think that just because one is higher advanced in technology doesn't necessarily mean they're smarter.
Well, that's true. That is true. I'll give you that. That's a good point.
So a couple quick questions. So if it was an in-air explosion, from the beginning of the furrow in the field to the end of it, the almost mile, if it exploded in the air, wouldn't there be pieces other places than just, you know, necessarily in that concentrated area? Was there anything found, like, you know, half mile other directions?
Well, the very first night after Brazel, the foreman, discovers this huge debris field, he goes back with his pickup truck, and there was a larger piece, about 10 foot in diameter, that he dragged behind the pickup truck. And he took 3 miles to the north, and he stored in a livestock shed that was still there till about 15 years ago. And in fact, even in the press release that went out on Tuesday, July 8th, that the Roswell Army Airfield issued, it says that the rancher stored the disc in a livestock shed until it was retrieved by the Army. Okay, so consistent.
Yeah.
It's just that they don't acknowledge the fact there was a whole debris field still out there that took 50 to 60 troops 3 full days to clean up, to gather up. There were 3 specific sites all connected to the one event. There's a debris field, midair explosion. It rains debris that covers that area almost a full mile long. About 2.5 miles east-southeast of the debris field, atop a bluff, which we call the D. Proctor site, based on one of the principal witnesses to the location, Brazel found something else.
Okay.
That was the terminology that was used. He found something else. Well, he and a number of children, including his son, Vernon, and Timothy D. Proctor, and Sidney Jack Wright, and one of the Eddington sisters, so we've been able to determine, they found 2 bodies that either had been drawn out by the percussion of the explosion or the decompression or the fact that another 25 miles from there, east-southeast along the same trajectory route, about 35 miles north of Roswell, there was a pod, a capsule.
Wow.
About the size of a Volkswagen Beetle.
Oh, my
God. Egg-shaped, described by numerous witnesses, including the sheriff, a fire crew chief, and numerous military at the site. Egg-shaped, about the size of a Volkswagen Beetle, 2 more bodies, and a survivor, 1 lone survivor. So 3 distinct sites, debris field, secondary body site, and an impact site, all part of one event. And witnesses to all 3 of these specific locations.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
And that's all the corroboration of all of these things compiled. And then, you know, it's such an insult to hear, well, it was a balloon. You know,
and how does the balloon create three separate crash sites?
Yeah,
you know, and a gouge for that matter.
Right.
No. Again, it does not compute. Right. It does not compute in the slightest. Right. And there is not a single witness, not one, who can place a balloon device or anything else conventional at the debris field, the secondary body site, or the impact site.
Wow.
Not a-
Now, we got about 2 minutes before break, but I just want to ask you this. So initially, there were several people holding pieces, and the, you had mentioned how they hid them so carefully and so completely, but every one of those was eventually recovered by the military? Is that right?
They made such an extreme effort in not only silencing the witnesses involved, more specifically the civilians, but also searching, ransacking houses, sheds, slitting open bags of feed, tipping over water tanks, pulling up floorboards, pulling out drawers and flipping over bed mattresses, all in an attempt to find every last piece of physical evidence. Now, the military has absolutely no authority over civilians,
right,
unless martial law is declared. Mm-hmm. In fact, if they come to your house with rifles drawn, we all know what we can tell them. Because they are trespassing. They have absolutely no authority against civilians. And yet, that's exactly what they did.
Man.
And the worst example would be poor Mac Brazel himself.
Hey everyone, this is Don with Paranormal Portal. Thanks for checking out the first part of The Real Roswell with Don Schmidt. If you'd like to hear the second part, that'll be up on next Wednesday. So check that out anywhere you get your podcast from. And of course, don't forget to check us out on YouTube. That's youtube.com/paranormalportal. And follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/paranormalportalradio.
sports betting is sweeping across the country faster than the coronavirus, and Wagering Week is your antidote. I'm Tom Martin, and I'm a veteran sports analyst and respected sports handicapper who helped build ESPN's brand. I've been recognized and awarded by Pro Football Weekly and Gaming Today magazine as the honest handicapper. Let the other guys give you the same old boring sports talk with the same tired storylines. We'll give it to you straight here every Friday on Wagering Week. Don't gamble with other podcasts. Let Sports Garden Network's Wagering Week help your bottom line.